This message comes from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting The Penguin Lessons, a new comedy starring Steve Coogan as a teacher whose life is upended after he rescues a penguin from an oil-slicked beach. Starts Friday, only in theaters. This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify. No idea where to sell? Shopify puts you in control of every sales channel. It is the commerce platform revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. Whether you're a garage entrepreneur or IPO ready, Shopify is the only tool you need to start, run, and grow your business without the struggle. Once you've reached your audience, Shopify has the internet's best converting checkout to help you turn them from browsers to buyers. Go to shopify.com/NPR to take your business to the next level today.
Hey, everyone. You're listening to Code Switch, the show about race and identity from NPR. I'm B.A. Parker. So I want to tell you about someone. Her name is Edna Bonhomme. Now, Edna is Haitian American, and when she was a little girl in 1980s Miami, she started running a very high fever. So high that her frightened parents had to take her to the hospital.
I had typhoid fever, that experience of feeling confined, not knowing what was going on, being separated from my parents temporarily, and how that elicited, at least at the time, and even subconsciously now, a sense of loss, a sense of loss of control, more specifically.
That moment of isolation was compounded by the fact that she was Haitian at a time when her community had been singled out by the CDC. The CDC had deemed these groups the 4-H's, so homosexuals, heroin users, hemophiliacs, and Haitians, as high risk of spreading HIV and AIDS. That was all a myth.
The Haitians in particular were vilified for no other reason than what I would consider to be anti-blackness. I would say that even with the anti-Haitian, anti-queer rhetoric that was being purported in the U.S. and other places during the HIV/AIDS epidemics, there was also groups of people in various contexts that resisted that rhetoric.
The experience of feeling confined in that hospital room and the idea that resistance can grow out of that confinement, these two things stuck with her, and they run through her book, A History of the World in Six Plagues, How Contagion, Class, and Captivity Shaped Us, from Cholera to COVID-19. In it, she breaks down case studies of epidemics that have greatly impacted marginalized communities throughout the world. We have a lot to learn from that history. And even now, the shortfalls in U.S. government rhetoric around diseases have found their way back into the forefront of how Americans are talking about outbreaks and epidemics. As bird flu ravages through our food systems and measles make a comeback, there's a question about how our current administration will handle these issues. Case in point, there's this moment in Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s confirmation hearing for becoming the new Secretary of Health. Senator Angela Alsobrooks of Maryland pushed back on Kennedy's reported comments that Black people need a different vaccination schedule.
What different vaccine schedule should I have received?
I mean, the pollen article suggests that Blacks need fewer antigens than
this is
dangerous. You get the same measles vaccine.
Mr. Kennedy, with all due respect, that is so dangerous. Your voice would be a voice that parents would listen to. That is so dangerous. I will be voting against your nomination
because
your views are dangerous to our state and to our country.
As we grapple with these public health concerns, we're talking to Edna Bonhomme about what we can learn from previous pandemics and lockdowns and how the past can inform, in particular, people of color on how to react to epidemics under the current administration.
This message comes from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting The Penguin Lessons, a new comedy directed by Peter Cataneo, starring Steve Coogan as a teacher whose life is upended after he rescues a penguin from an oil-slicked beach in Argentina, 1976. Starts Friday, only in theaters. This message comes from BetterHelp. Therapy can be expensive, but at BetterHelp, they believe therapy should feel accessible, not like a luxury. which is why they offer quality care at a price that makes sense and can help you with anything from anxiety to everyday stress. Your mental health is worth it, and now it's within reach. Visit BetterHelp.com/NPR to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp.com/NPR. This message comes from Thuma. Create your oasis with Thuma, a modern design company that specializes in furniture and home goods. By stripping away everything but the essential, Thuma makes elevated beds with premium materials and intentional details. With clean lines, subtle curves, and minimalist style, the Thuma bed collection is available in 4 signature finishes to match any design aesthetic. To get $100 towards your first bed purchase, go to thuma.co/NPR. Support for NPR comes from the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org.
So, Edna, in your book, you focus on 6 plagues that have affected vulnerable populations in the past 200 years or so. And one of the main arguments you make is that epidemics and global pandemics often lay the groundwork for future mistakes. Do you see any parallels between the government response to some of the plagues you discuss in the book and the way that this current administration is approaching public health, both here at home and abroad?
Yeah, so as someone who is trained in biology, one of the things that I was well-versed in then and now is the importance and significance of germ theory, which in a sense, germ theory is something that really starts to develop in the 19th century. And that is to say, the scientific theory that microorganisms such as bacteria, viruses, and parasites, which are often the primary causes of infectious diseases, are what makes people sick. Our understanding of germ theory has been quite pivotal to our development of sanitation practices, the development of antibiotics, and preventative and therapeutic measures. And this is important to note because there has been an abandonment of science, I would say, within the current political administration and how we can, you know, tackle things like infectious diseases can be addressed more easily if we have robust vaccination campaigns. At the current moment, there have been outbreaks, sadly, of measles, which for decades had been under control because of more assertive vaccination policies. And that is slowly but surely going away, given the current administration. I think one of the things that we are going to be witnessing over the next maybe 4 years, decade, or couple decades is the reemergence or perhaps new emergence of outbreaks. So, for example, as of January of this year of 2025, the Ministry of Health in Uganda officially declared an Ebola outbreak in the nation's capital in Kampala. And this is the 8th Ebola outbreak in Uganda since 2000. And it's quite unfortunate because the Ugandan government has appealed for emergency health funds. And without the necessary funding, it's going to be difficult for not just Uganda, but surrounding countries to control the disease. I guess time will tell what will happen in Uganda. But that's just one case study of how a very real public health and public foreign aid is going to potentially impact whether or not the Ebola outbreak in Uganda will proliferate.
One thing I'm curious about is I know your book has a global perspective and that you wrote it while living through the COVID lockdown in Germany. And as I was reading it, I kept wondering about the history of confinement and experimentation on marginalized folks and what happens when that history collides with new outbreaks. So how do these communities get past the mistrust in medical establishment and mistrust in the government. Like, how did that come up in your research? Did that come up in your research?
Yeah, so the chapter that I have on COVID-19 focuses on three people. Mm-hmm. And these three people are people of African descent who live in Germany. And I wanted to get a sense precisely on this question, like, to what extent are individuals skeptical of the disease? Are they skeptical of the vaccine? Or are other things happening? And what I did was I interviewed them, these individuals, for about 2 years and regularly calling them and so forth. And what I found is that there was, in the initial stages, a bit of doubt about what was happening in the broader political sphere. But nevertheless, what I came to see is that they also saw how people that they loved and cared about were directly impacted by the outbreak, or in some cases were abandoned by very basic public health policies. Or, and this is a thing that we came to see, is that in some cases, certain Black communities globally were disproportionately impacted by the virus, not because of some biological component, but because of they were often the essential workers that were unable to carry out social distancing. Mm-hmm. And also the segregation that happens in people's labor and the type of jobs people are forced to do by virtue of racism, I would argue, that they were more exposed. And I think over time, the skepticism that would sometimes be coming from Black communities wasn't out of nowhere. It was often coming from the abandonment by society. Mm. And the ways that people felt left behind. And some of that still exists today. And in a sense, the way that one can deal with these forms of skepticism is not by talking down to a person and or being condescending, but to try to understand why people believe what they do. And to be frank, with respect to COVID, at least, some people were quite distrustful that the government would provide a free COVID vaccine when the government did not provide free universal health care. Mm. So I think that this is also a situation in which trust has to be built well before an outbreak occurs, and those relationships need to be strong, and the history of anti-Blackness in medicine and science also have to be attended to as one wants to build trust within a community.
How do you build trust between a marginalized community and the organizations that are tasked with controlling outbreaks of disease before they turn into full-blown epidemics?
Yeah, so I think that that's an important question, and I wouldn't say that I have a magic bullet to address all of those concerns.
Yeah.
But I think one of the primary things that have to happen in the U.S., which is very much available in other industrialized nations, is developing a universal healthcare system and program so that everyone has access to healthcare. Because then that becomes a basis for people knowing that health is truly a public and societal given and entitlement that we all deserve. Mm-hmm. And beyond that, having community health centers that are well-funded and robust, that people can go and ask questions about, you know, what is impacting them. Having, particularly in the case of people who end up being pregnant, midwives that could provide the prenatal and postnatal care, and having town halls where people can discuss health. And those town halls could be in person, they could be virtual, they can be in multiple languages to reflect a diversity of communities that exist in the United States, the linguistic diversity that is, as well as ethnic. And this is not something that will happen overnight. It requires a well-funded program where people are actually able to feel as if they have agency over their lives. And in a way that we haven't fully witnessed in the U.S. because of the aggressive forms of austerity and defunding of basic social services. Yeah. But if we want to build trust, if we want to ensure that people feel like they're part of a collective and coming together, we need to put the money there in public health institutions so that everyone feels like they are taken care of and that they can live a long and healthy life.
Coming up.
So in a sense, resistance could happen through care, resistance can happen through protest, and resistance could also happen through survival.
Stay with us.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Boll & Branch. Experience the softness of 100% organic cotton sheets. Take 20% off during the annual spring event at bollandbranch.com with code NPR. Limited time only. Exclusions apply. See site for details. This message comes from Mint Mobile. Mint Mobile took what's wrong with wireless and made it right. They offer premium wireless plans for less, and all plans include high-speed data, unlimited talk and text, and nationwide coverage. See for yourself at mintmobile.com/switch. This message comes from Bombas. Nearly 30% of marathoners end their race blistered. Bombas running socks are strategically cushioned to help say bye to blisters. Run to bombas.com/NPR and use code NPR for 20% off your first purchase.
Parker, just Parker. Code switch. And we're back with author Edna Bonhomme. Her book is called A History of the World in Six Plagues, and it looks at the way that governments and people in power respond to epidemics and how they affect marginalized communities throughout the world. It's also a story of how resistance can flourish, even as authorities seize on public health crises to constrain the most vulnerable among us. Here's the rest of our conversation. Okay, I want to circle back to the beginning of your book where you zero in on the story of the 1800s and the cholera outbreak and the way it spread in plantations in the United States. And it's such a harrowing disease, but it seemed like a really important inflection point or like an important place to start in the book. And why did you choose that point? And why was that important for you?
Yeah, so I wanted to start with the 1840s and 50s because this was also the period where microbiology, as we understand it, started to develop. The International Sanitary Commission, which was a new project where various countries came together, mostly European, to think about how could they create international regulations around public health and coordinate on that. At the same time, this was also a period in which chattel slavery was alive and thriving in ways that meant that a subset of the world's population in the Americas, in the United States, the Caribbean, South America, people of African descent were forced to work without wages. And various people have written extensive and beautiful and thoughtful histories of that region, of this practice, and to clearly outline how detrimental it's been. And what I wanted to do was to think about what is that relationship between the rise of modern science as we know it and public health regimens and regimes, and then also the kind of very brutal force of social organization, torture camps, the plantation, and how it reckoned with disease and infection and maternal mortality. And I thought that to have an honest conversation about how we understand race and science today within the context of the US, we have to go back into the 1800s and see how very racist ideas about Black people's humanity, specifically whether or not they experience pain, people's ideas or misconceptions about intellectual capabilities, a lot of that emerged in the 19th century. And I wanted to look deeply into the texts, medical and otherwise, that that tried to present itself as science, but really was a way to justify racism. And that in spite of those texts, and I looked at archival materials such as plantation manuals and so forth, to be able to see how did those texts work against the perspective and the accounts and autobiographies of formerly enslaved people who through various means liberated themselves and also spoke about what it meant to be sick and ill and find some form of healing. And that what did it also mean, especially after there was emancipation in the US, how did the Reconstruction period influence the ways in which Black medical schools developed, Black doctors were being trained, and the conditions for possibility once people felt as if health should be a right that everyone should be entitled to, and that it could be seen as something that was part of the imagination of Black folk once they were free. Hence the reason that the Freedmen's Bureau during Reconstruction did form a Department of Health. And I wonder, I often wonder if the Reconstruction had continued and really realized itself to the full capacity, would we have had universal healthcare in the United States in the 19th century?
With the Freedmen's Bureau, are there any parallels with with the present day institutions that deal with public health? I'm thinking of, you know, like Health and Human Services or the CDC.
Yeah, so the Freedmen's Bureau, as people have written about, provided basic necessities like food, shelter, medical care to freed people. They established schools, they purchased lands, they provided family members with jobs and so forth. And this is important to note that this was something that was carried out at the level of the government. What we have now in the U.S. are often suggestions or a means-tested way of giving out aid to people. So that is to say, if one is poor, then you can apply for Medicaid, and or if one is over the age of 65, you are entitled to Medicare. However, there isn't an equivalent of a universal program in which everyone, irrespective of how much money they make or don't, that they are entitled to health care. We do have this, which is something that did come from the Reconstruction period, universal public education from kindergarten to 12th grade. And that's something that we should strive for, not just in education, but in health. Mm-hmm. And so although we have a CDC in the US, which is absolutely pivotal in terms of providing research, evidence-based policies and suggestions, it itself does not ensure that everyone is provided with basic health care for free in the ways that, for example, the National Health Service in the UK establishes for its population.
So early in your book, you say that segregated spaces might be perceived as petri dishes of disease, but they also function as sites of resistance. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so I think that the second half of the book, in a sense, looks at the relationship between confinement and resistance in a broad sense, as well as within the context of the case studies that are put forth. So The chapter on HIV and incarceration considers how people, and specifically these women who were at Bedford Hills Prison, try to form community and try to take care of each other, even while some of the people who were incarcerated were HIV positive and could be scapegoated, but were not. And I would see the care work that was happening at the level of the community groups that they formed as a site of resistance. And there was another way in which resistance happened in another chapter on Ebola, where I look at the neighborhood of West Point in Monrovia, Liberia, where residents of that neighborhood had to undergo a lockdown at the level of the neighborhood. And part of what was difficult is that they were expected to be confined to this space without a lot of government support or explanation for how long it would be initially. And beyond that, people were being told that something was wrong with them. And they resisted to the extent that many of them just protested against the militarization of their neighborhood. And one of the public health officials I spoke to for the book pointed out that they learned from that mistake and that they found other mechanisms to educate the public, to have conversations, and then also to train more health workers from the country so that when outbreaks could occur, that it wasn't being done so at the level of a draconian fashion. So in a sense, resistance can happen through care, resistance can happen through protests, and resistance could also happen through survival, through coming to terms with what is happening around one's community, through like meditation in some cases, to also acknowledging, knowing that there was a lot of power in surviving this outbreak and so many others.
Okay, finally, it feels like this book is about trauma. The trauma that nations have had over wars, pandemics, disease, and part of this book is your own personal experience, especially during, you know, the height of COVID-19, the pandemic. And I'm wondering, did writing with this book help with that for you? Like, to sit with and think about this wild, unprecedented, or with this book shows precedented time we all just went through?
So I would say that the book, in a sense, is less about trauma and more about loss. Mm-hmm. And when I think about loss, I'm also reminded of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who is or was a psychologist who focused on bereavement and death, where she said, "The most beautiful people we have known are those who have known defeat, known suffering, known struggle, known loss, and have found their way out of those depths." And the book, in a sense, is a gesture towards a renewal or a sense of showing what can be possible even when there is a mass epidemic. I want readers to be curious about the diseases that I spoke about and at the same time to consider how science operates, how humans have found imaginative ways to organize themselves and to think deeply about what health means for themselves and their community. And in a sense, it's also a book that is trying to consider how we don't have to sit in a place of defeat, but rather in one in which history can be a tool for helping us deal with the institutions that need more life and more breath. And so I hope the book could be a kind of initiative or ignite people's idea about investing in primary preventive healthcare to redistribute the resources we have, not just in the United States, but on the global scale, and to not further scapegoat people or marginalize people based off of their ethnicity or race, but rather to think about how we can do better for each other in ways that we haven't always.
with this like 5-year anniversary, and there seems to be this, I don't know, there seems to be like this historical amnesia, especially around lockdowns and the political tensions surrounding constrainment as a form of public health. Was it a, I guess, was it a net good that we went into lockdowns in the way that we did? And have we learned anything about it for maybe the next one?
Yeah, to an extent, there is a bit of historical amnesia about what happened 5 years ago. But at the same time, I think that various people, particularly individuals that I know who have written about the HIV/AIDS epidemic, people who have lived through that, are well aware that one can't just forget. Mm. I think for anyone who's lost a relative and know from COVID or any epidemic and knows what the brutal turn that can happen when we don't respect human life, that they haven't forgotten. What we, I guess, owe each other is to constantly look towards history, not just as a kind of static event, but rather the dynamism that we're still living through. And it's for that reason that I wrote this book, that I'm in conversation with people who want to reflect about the politics and the social impact of the lockdown, both the good and the bad, but also to consider and to think about, well, what was missing, what could we do better for the next major outbreak? And I think we're still learning, but I do have hope that we can, with evidence-based purchase and the funding and a bit of care, that we can do better.
Edna, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me on Code Switch.
And that's our show. You can follow us on Instagram at NPR Code Switch. If email is more your thing, ours is codeswitch@npr.org. And subscribe to the podcast on the NPR app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also subscribe to the Code Switch newsletter by going to npr.org/codeswitchnewsletter. And just a reminder that signing up for Code Switch Plus is a great way to support our show and public media. And you'll get to listen to every episode sponsor-free. So please go find out more at plus.npr.org/codeswitch. This episode was produced by Xavier Lopez. It was edited by Luis Treyes and Dahlia Mortada. Our engineer was Jimmy Keeley. And a big shout out to the rest of the Code Switch Massive, Christina Kahla, Jess Kung, Leah Donella, Courtney Stein, Violin Williams, and Jean Demby. I'm B.A. Parker. Hydrate.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure. AI needs lots of speed and computing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling? Upgrade to Oracle Cloud Infrastructure. OCI is the blazing fast and secure platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI workloads. Now, till the end of March 31st, 2025, new U.S. customers with a minimum financial commitment can cut their current cloud bill in half. See if your company qualifies at oracle.com/NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Bowl & Branch. Change your sleep with airy blankets, cloud-like duvets, and buttery soft sheets. Save 20% during the annual spring event at bowlandbranch.com with code NPR. Limited time only. Exclusions apply. See site for details. This message comes from your part-time controller. They're experts in nonprofit accounting, and their services are customizable to your nonprofit's specific needs. Learn more at yptc.com.